morning. Happy Father's Day to all of you. I can't say that to myself, that's weird. So, happy Father's Day to all of you. And, as every Sunday morning, it has nothing to do with us, so we're not preaching about Father's Day. And so, with all of that in mind, let's start with a word of prayer, and then we'll dig into our text for this morning. Bow with me, please. Dear Lord, as we come before you, we thank you so much for the opportunity of prayer. We thank you that we can come before you, that we have someone who, upon whom we can depend, who can guide us through our frailties. As we grow older, as we become more aware, as we even just spend time in your word, we see the inadequacy of humanity. And so as we dwell upon that a little bit, as we come before you looking for the strength to not only understand your word, but to then apply it to ourselves, we pray that you would enable that effort. Would you bless this time in the word? Would it have meaning for us? Would it have validity for us? And would it quicken our hearts to yearn, to be more diligent, to give more, to strive more for you, Lord, because you are the ultimate worthy one. You are unfathomable, immeasurable, and majestic beyond all compare. And so I pray, would we be blown away by who you are, and would it truly shine forth from your word this morning, we pray. In your holy name, amen. So if you remember back to the last time we were in Genesis, we saw the flood recede, we saw the waters pull back, we saw Noah test the extent of the flood by sending out a raven and a dove. The dove he sent out twice, but when it didn't return, he knew that the land was dry enough for them to come out. And they and all the animals came out of the ark, after which Noah makes an offering, and God makes a promise. And it's with that promise that we segue into our text today. Look at chapter 8, verses 20 and 21. Then Noah built an altar to Yahweh and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And Yahweh smelled the soothing aroma. And Yahweh said to himself, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again strike down every living thing as I have done. We know that God is omniscient. We know that he is all-knowing. So God is not surprised at the condition of mankind. Mankind has a tendency to look horizontally and judge like to like. You're like me. And if I compare myself to you, I can see how I'm doing. I'm either better or worse than you, right? And because of that, mankind tends to think of more highly of themselves than they ought to. Remember, we're not reading Genesis as a collection of autobiographies where each character is getting a chance to tell their story. We are reading a history that was written for the sake of giving its recipients a background. The Israelites are the ones who are being introduced to their God. They are learning about who he is and the extent of this covenant that they've just entered into with him. What would they have thought of the idea that man's heart is evil from his youth? I imagine like people today who live lives either apart or with God, this is still a shocking idea. They are surprised by this idea. We're not so bad. What is it that makes us evil? That's kind of a big word. Not understanding who it is that they sin against, not understanding even the severity of the smallest of sins. Today in chapter 9, we see this statement proven, that man's heart is truly evil from his youth. We see that even if the conditions are perfect, sin remains. We will see today 3 points that will show us, even in the best of circumstances, given the perfect environment, man's heart is evil and cannot cease to sin. Even the best of men will fail. There's an assumption with mankind today. We see it in the Catholic version of faith and the legalistic traditions. We see it in mankind as a whole, that after man has been cleansed, they need to go and do better, to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and to use this second chance to bring about a different outcome. But what mankind needs to realize is that the intent of our hearts is evil from our youth, that our starting point is evil, that we are not basically good, that left to our own devices, we can do nothing that is good. And we need the intervention of God at all times, or we will return to our wicked ways. And that's what the Israelites needed to learn as well. They've already seen this. They're just coming off of their covenant promise to God, where they have said, "All that you command, we will do." And not even 40 days later, they make for themselves an idol. They've experienced how quickly they return to the ways of the world around them. And I imagine them, like us, always had excuses. We didn't know any better. We were trying to worship God as best as we knew how to do. This is how we've been raised. We've been in Egypt for generations. What else do we know? We thought this is how people worship their God. This is how we would honor God. It's what our neighbors do. And it's in our example today that we learn that this is the condition of mankind at every time, apart from the intervention of God. That this will be continue to be the pattern of their lives, apart from God doing something miraculous in them. That in the end, man apart from God cannot be good, cannot save themselves. It isn't just a matter of circumstance, nature over nurture, but a condition of the heart. Man's heart is evil from his youth. So therein, we is our intro, and that brings us into our first point, which are found in verses 1 through 7, where we see God reinstate the blessing of Genesis 1 upon mankind. And I titled this point, "The Righteous Remnant," and hopefully that's clear and by the time we're done. Genesis 9, verses 1 to 7. Let's read. "And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. As with a green plant, I give all to you. However, flesh, with its life, that is its blood, you shall not eat. Surely I will require your life blood. From every living thing I will require it. And from every man, from each man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful and multiply. Swarm on the earth and multiply in it.'" That sounds fairly familiar, doesn't it? What we have here is a version of what was given to Adam in Genesis 1. If you can, keep your finger here, it's not very far, and flip back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And just for our own recollection, we're going to read the original blessing in comparison with what we just read. So Genesis 1, 26. And it says there, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, so that they will have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' And God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that creeps on the earth.' Then God said, 'Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has the fruit of the tree yielding seed, it shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that creeps on the earth, which has life, I have given every green plant for food.' And it was so." So, not the same, right? Clearly, but what we see, similarities in phrasing and scope. Because what we have with Noah is a restatement of this blessing. It's different, but it's almost a restart. We see the same command to be fruitful and multiply that we have for Noah in Genesis 9. We see the same reasoning that because man is in the image of God, this is why all of this is upon them and not on one of the animals. We see the dominion that was given to Adam, whereas for Noah, there is a fear upon the animals, a different way of accomplishing that same dominion that is commanded by God, right? Before, the animals were in the dominion of man, submitted to man under their purview as they ruled over creation. But now, because of sin, they are afraid of man. still given into the hands of men, still ruled over by men, but now by fear. We see a restating of the role of man, the purpose of man, the blessing that is upon man. These are actually the only imperatives in the text of chapter 9, like they are in Genesis 1, be fruitful, multiply, and fill. So we see God remaking the world, restarting back at square one. God has wiped sin from the world. Everyone is dead except those who are in the ark, without the provision of the Lord, the righteous few who will remember that, we will remember that Noah is the only one that's declared righteous, the only righteous person left on the earth. We saw that in Genesis 7:1, where Yahweh said to Noah, "Enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this generation." And God takes this righteous remnant and starts again, giving them the blessing and the commands to have the dominion and to fill the earth, and then declares their position over the earth. But he doesn't leave it there. This time there is no command to not eat of the tree of good and evil, because that's not available, but there is still a command to not eat. Look at verse 4. "However, flesh with its life, that is its blood, you shall not eat. Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every living thing I will require it, and from every man, from each man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." In Genesis 1, we saw the command to not eat of the tree in the middle of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now we see a command to not eat of the flesh of its life, right? Different, but still a reflective parallel. Anything with its blood. Before, we didn't see that command because then people didn't eat meat. We didn't see that all the animals were given as food. Like, it didn't say that then, like it does here in verse 3, where every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. This wasn't a thing before death came into the world, but now it is part of the provision of the Lord. Eat meat. Eat it all. Every moving thing that is alive. That's pretty all-encompassing. So in your mind right away, it may be coming up, you may be wondering how that works with the dietary restrictions that we know of the Old Testament. These are that were upon the Israelites. Clearly, Noah knew something of the law, right? We saw in chapter 8 that he only sacrificed clean animals, right? But I think we have to keep in mind the progression of what is revealed. The Israelites who are hearing this from Noah, from Moses, know the law. They understand what they are allowed to eat and what not. But Noah, though he understood what to sacrifice, likely didn't have all the laws that the Israelites do. Here, Noah is given all the animals, every moving thing that is alive, from the cattle in the field to the creepy crawly under your floorboards. Now, though all of it can be food, doesn't mean we're required to eat it all, but it also doesn't make it wrong. You know, I made the joke to my coworkers, if I'm ever truly hungry, their dogs aren't safe. though I'm making a joke and I'm trying to remove them from the love of their animals a little bit, the reality is still there. If we were starving and in the desert and we saw a locust, which is a giant grasshopper thing, I assume we'd eat it. Like, you're hungry enough, right? I'm not even going to go further with that. But even with that statement that everything is given to us as food, there's still a don't eat encompassed within that. And that's flesh with its life, with its blood, shall not be eaten. Now, this often gets people going with their steak preference and whatever else. You know, medium rare is this close to divine or whatever the rules are, I'm not sure. But I think we tend to miss the point. There is a history that that is recorded even of people eating living animals or animals still with blood in them. There's something here that God is addressing that's more than just the clear or the present reading, I think. So just to kind of give you a phrase or an example, there's a history of the people that we now call Ethiopians in northern Africa, and they would be driving their cattle or having an ox pull a cart, and they would cut out a piece of their hind quarter while they were driving because they were hungry. Now, they didn't want to kill the animal. This was likely their only one, or maybe only one of a few. And so while the animal is alive, they would cut out a chunk and chow down as they drove. And the animal would heal and they would no longer be hungry. And this is, you know, so there is real things that we see humanity get to that could very well be addressed here, right? And it's just an example to kind of show us the extent of where the human mind will get to. People left to their devices will eat all kinds of things, and this will actually cause them to get sick. Now, this is how this passage is often understood. Because things can make you sick, God was providing for you and offering these commands to protect you, right? Some things you can eat raw and be fine, other things you can't, because raw meat carries disease. Blood is an incredible carrier of disease. And so God is making a law, and he's trying to be safe, and he's protecting you. But I still don't think that's the ultimate point. God is really stressing something in this text when we see him keep talking about the lifeblood. You know, who taking life, whoever, you know, that their life is then required. There's something here that is abhorrent, I think, to God. And so there's a strong history even of people drinking blood. And before I get too off into the historical things of what people have done, God is getting at something specific. Verse 5, just to kind of reiterate, surely I will require your lifeblood. Verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. That's the stress here. It isn't safety. It isn't the fact that you can catch a disease. All very true, but man is special. They're not the same as animals. And whoever sheds man's blood, be they animal or man, their lifeblood is required. And so blood is symbolic of that life that is from God. The thing that isn't natural, this is something that supernaturally happens. God is the one who gives life. Man is made in the image of God. They are to be regarded differently than all of the rest of creation. Their life is a gift from God, and so in some sense of the word, it is meant to be revered. The reason we don't take suicide lightly or euthanasia lightly or any of those things lightly is the taking of someone's life, the reason we don't take all of those things lightly is because man is intervening in something that God has given. We protect what God has given. And it belongs to God, and it is to be treated as such. So whether it be the blood that is the symbol of the life of man or life itself, they are pointing to the same thing, that life is from God and is given for a purpose. God doesn't just frivolously give a life. You know, you don't have accidental children. They are all from God. Every life is from God. Treat it with its proper respect. And so whether man is killed by an animal or another man, the result is the same. Now, we don't see this law enforced all the time, right? When Cain killed Abel, we don't see God require his life. In fact, God protected Cain from being killed out of vengeance because this wasn't the law then yet. Same with Lamech. When he killed a man for striking him, there wasn't a requirement of his life because this wasn't the law then yet, but now after Noah it is. This is another blessing from God, right? We're seeing God protect his people for sure, but there is these blessings that he is instituting. A protection against the lawlessness of man, of what was before. There's something to fear when the consequence is death, and the death penalty stands in stark contrast to the difference in value between a man and an animal. Right, we can all testify to the fact that to some extent that's been forgotten today, right? People make comparisons between man and creature, man and animal all the time. I couldn't help myself. I had to find a ridiculous case of animals being treated or revered too much. And so I found a case of, in 2018 in Oregon, a judge stopped a horse from suing its owner. No, the horse didn't actually file the lawsuit. There was a legal defense fund that did it, but it was a genuine case that required the ruling of a judge to throw it out of court. So the horse was looking for $100,000 in damages from its owner. This is the world we live in. There are genuine things that we need judges for, that we need a court for, And we got horses in line. I had to find something ridiculous. I knew there would be one. But this is the world we live in. It almost seems like a joke. We've lost common sense, and it's been replaced with insanity, and it's portrayed as normal. And all because man no longer defines things the way God does and has lost the distinction between man and animals, that God has placed a different value on his image bearers than he has on the rest of creation. Kill an animal, as long as it's legally yours and not your neighbor's, there's no penalty. Kill a person, regardless of who it is, the requirement is your life in turn. Even the Mosaic Law gave room for inadvertent or accidental killing, even for war. But when the charge is murder, the cost is clear, because it sets the general pattern for all mankind to use. There is a difference between man and animal. We are not just higher thinking animals. We are not just cousins of the chimpanzee. We are something unique, something set apart. So why the difference? And it's not because man has developed some kind of intrinsic value of their own, but it's because of who man represents, because of whose image man carries, because God has declared it so. And so if we seek to eliminate God from the world and from our understanding of the world, if we seek to eliminate God from what we frame as reality, what are we left with? Insanity. God ends this paragraph with a redeclaration of the command to be fruitful and multiply, swarm on the earth and multiply in it. He made the world for man. Man is not a parasite killing off what God designed as an entity in itself. The earth was created for man, and man is to have dominion over it, to fill it entirely with the image of God, and to have dominion over it. This was always the intention, even with Adam, that the earth would be full of those who bore the image of God, who lived as God declared, who worshipped the God of all that was made. They partook of his goodness, they reveled in who he was, and they celebrated him with true and genuine worship. And so here God starts again with a righteous man, giving him the same blessing, the same commands, and sending him forward with the same mission to fill the world with those who follow God and his commands. So we're seeing a bit of a setup here. I'll give you that till we get to the end of the chapter. We've got our setting, which brings us then to our second point, which I titled Man's Redemption Ratified. And it's found in Genesis 9, verses 8 to 17, where it says, "Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, 'As for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. Indeed, I establish my covenant with you, and all the flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, and there shall never again be a flood to destroy the earth.' Then God said, 'This is the sign of the covenant which I am giving to be between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I put my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. And it will be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. So the bow shall be in the cloud, and I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth.' And God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.'" Now, I title this Man's Redemption Ratified. Ratified is not a word that we use much anymore. And if you haven't looked it up in your phone yet, it means for a deal to be proven. So when you make a deal, the deal is ratified when the signatures are done and witnessed, when it's all verified and complete. That deal is ratified. It's proven. Now what we see in our text here is that God not only takes the blessing that he has given Noah, but he guarantees it on himself. No requirement of Noah or of his descendants. This is simply how it will be from now on. Remember back to our passage in Genesis 8:28, where Yahweh said to himself, "I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again strike down every living creature as I have done." God says this to himself. Noah has no idea about this. If it wasn't for God revealing it to Moses, we would have no idea about this. But God says he will never again curse the ground because of man. Regardless of the fact that they are evil in their hearts from the youth, God goes on to say in verse 22 that while all the days of the earth remain, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. But now in verse 8 and onwards, we see God lay out this covenant with Noah. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons, and he tells them that he is going to establish this with them, with their seed, and with every living creature that is with them. This is a worldwide covenant, and it's sealed by God's bow, like from a bow and arrow, being put in the clouds. God's implement of war being hung up as a sign of his relinquishing that one consequence against sin. Never again would the world as a whole be destroyed by a flood. What we notice here is that God is making it clear this is of him and by him. We'll notice the phrase, I establish, repeated three times throughout this section of text. First, God makes it clear who this covenant is with. Verse 9, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, etc. and etc. And then he moves on in verse 11 where God says what that covenant is. Indeed, I establish my covenant with you that all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, and there shall never again be a flood to destroy the earth. But he doesn't leave it there. We see that continue in verse 17. It's summed up. This is the sign of the covenant which I established. I have established. Right? He gives a sign, the rainbow. So this is not just some short sign, but one that will last as long as the covenant does. One that is hanging in the heaven and is seen whenever it rains. Doesn't matter how bad it rains, how much we think, oh, the floods are coming again. The promise of God still stands, that never again will the earth be destroyed by a flood. In fact, God says, the bow shall be in the cloud. I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And so what we see here is the loving kindness of God displayed. Despite the fact that he knows that man's heart is wicked and the intent of his heart is evil continually, God has decided that he will not destroy man in this way again. Noah is the one righteous man, not meaning he was perfect, but a man who pursued the will of God, held on to the graces given by God, lived as God commanded, obeyed God. Noah was righteous in the eyes of God because he believed what God said. God says it's going to rain. Noah has no idea what rain is, but God says it's going to rain and says, tells him to build a boat. He builds a boat. God says, he does. We actually see that at the end of chapter 8. When Noah offers all of these sacrifices that we read about, why do we think he did that? First thing Noah does, steps off the ark, builds an altar, and he takes of every clean animal, of every clean bird, and offers burnt offerings on the altar. Why would Noah do that? Why would that be his first action? Well, a burnt offering was a particular offering. In Leviticus 1:4, it tells us what they were for. And he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. A burnt offering was a general offering of atonement, a recognition of one's sin, of one's being a sinner, and them then bringing an offering, looking for atonement. Noah gets out of the ark, recognizes the cost of sin, realizes that that could have been him. Though he is considered righteous, it's not as if he is without sin. And it's not only him who is saved, but his whole family. Noah realizes the cost of sin. He sees what God thinks of sin and realizes the debt that all mankind owes to God. And so he offers up a sacrifice of atonement as a recognition of his own state and the state of his family, but also the blessed provision of God in providing a way of redemption from the cost of sin for him and his family. It was all of God. God created man. God determined how man was supposed to live. What did man do? Man sinned. God said that that was enough and determined how man should be punished. Noah was seen as righteous, and God then provided a way for Noah and his family to survive the coming doom. God closed them up in the ark. We remember that verse where he said God closed the door. God kept them as he washed away the sins of the world. God brought them through the judgment to the other side, restoring them and the whole world to a fresh start, even going as far as reinstating the covenant with Noah that God first made with Adam. God has done it all. And it reminds me of that quote by Edwards, "You contribute nothing to your salvation except the sin that made it necessary." I think we see that super clearly right here. Noah didn't do much of anything, but God still, through him, gave us this example. And so, I think the message is clear. Man has sinned and they need a redeemer. God, in his infinite mercy and grace, has decided to provide a way, to provide the redemption needed. And he ratifies it with a sign by hanging up his own bow in the heavens to remind us of his eternal covenant with all of creation. Which then brings us to our third point, which I titled, "The Heart's Readiness to Regress." This point is found in our final chunk of verses 18 to 28. "Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was scattered abroad. Then Noah began to be a man of the land and planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself in his tent. Then Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took the garment and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned backward so that they did not see their father's nakedness. Then Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, 'Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers.' And he said, 'Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant.' And Noah lived 350 years after the flood, so all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died." What we've seen so far is that God has punished the world for their sin. He sent a flood that destroyed everything and killed everyone within whom was the breath of life, except for Noah, his family, and the animals on the ark. Noah, as God said, was the only righteous man left, and so God preserved him through this judgment. Now we see them disembark the ark, these eight people, and God begins again, restating the covenant that he began with Adam, and then God expands on that covenant with Noah that he will never again destroy the world with a flood. So we see the setup. Now we see the punchline. God takes what is a righteous man, one who loves and follows God, gives him a new creation without sin, removing all influence and corruption. God then makes a promise saying that never again will he bring about this judgment, having redeemed man from the flood, having saved them from the consequences of sin and provided a promise by which they never need face that judgment again. We now see, which can't be too much later, even in spite of all of this blessing and provision, man's return to sin. We see some interesting points of focus in this text. So as we seek to understand what it says, we're going to kind of slowly walk through it. In verses 18 and 19, we see the sons of Noah listed. But right at the end of verse 18, we see this small phrase, "And Ham was the father of Canaan." That's interesting, because there weren't any children on the ark, right? There were eight people on the ark. And why is only the one kid mentioned? Canaan, who is Ham's fourth son, is mentioned here. It's not like the other sons didn't have children. They did. But this one in particular is mentioned. Interesting and worth noting. Then we get to verse 20 and 21, where we see Noah's sin. "Then Noah began to be a man of the land and planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk and covered himself inside of his tent." Now there's oodles of speculation of what this means. If you want to have a lot of reading to do, start digging into these things. There's lots. It seems straightforward, but once we realize the consequences and how they fall out, it raises some questions. Noah, now off the ark, no longer consumed with building the ark, finds a new occupation. He becomes a farmer, a man of the land, and he plants a vineyard, and of that makes wine, drinks the wine, and becomes drunk. And as many before and after who have ignored the warnings of moderation, Noah makes some bad decisions. Now we know there's nothing wrong with being a farmer. There's nothing wrong with planting a vineyard, and there's nothing wrong with drinking wine. As we've already seen, every plant and every animal has been given to us for food. And a natural way to keep juice in a society without refrigeration is to ferment it. We see what happens to communion juice in our fridge after a while, let alone what happens when you don't have any refrigeration and are in a desert. Fermenting is just a way of keeping it for longer. So whatever wasn't consumed or dried was turned into juice, and then whatever wasn't consumed in this way was turned into wine. Noah then drinks of the wine, and he becomes drunk. Here we see an explicit sin. The Bible is clear about drunkenness. On one hand, we see that wine is given by God, Psalm 104, 14, and 15. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, the vegetation for man's cultivation to bring forth food from the earth, and wine, which makes man's heart glad, to make his face glisten more than oil, and food, which sustains man's heart. We see all the many good things that God has given in order for man to see and experience the goodness of God. But living isn't eating and drinking. Life is found in Christ. Everything is meant to be done to the glory of God, and this is not meant to be understood without self-control. Proverbs 20, verse 1, wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. In fact, the Bible makes it clear that Noah's situation is not uncommon, but rather a common byproduct of overindulging. Lamentations 4, verse 21, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, who inhabits the land of Uz, but the cup will pass on to you as well. You will become drunk and make yourself naked. Nakedness is almost a byproduct of drunkenness, and drunkenness is always to be avoided because it controls people. Ephesians 5:18 says, do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. Both of these control men. Drunkenness to debauchery or sin, and spirit to holiness. Clearly there is a call upon mankind, even back in the Old Testament, to follow the ways of God above their own. The reality is that Noah was not self-controlled, and he became drunk, and he uncovered himself in his tent. So now this may seem like it's minor. It's so Noah got naked in his tent. It's not like he was running down the middle of Main Street, right? It's just weird that it's making a huge point of it. It doesn't seem like he did anything particularly egregious. Now, there is much speculation as this story continues, but we will try and stay directly in the text. The Bible doesn't expand on what Noah did or what happened with Noah, and so I say we leave it at that. But that is not to say that Noah wasn't acting shamefully. The point being made here in the original is not that he was just disrobed and passed out. The point is being made here that he acted in a sinful way. What that was, we have no idea, and it's not up to us to fill in the blank. But what is interesting is the connection here between Noah and Adam. What was the first thing that Adam and Eve did after they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? They realized they were naked, and they were ashamed. So they made clothes out of fig leaves for themselves in order to cover their shame. Interestingly enough, we have the new covenant holder Noah, and it's almost in reverse. He's clothed, and he reveals his shame by uncovering himself. Right? We're seeing these constant connections back to the original example. The story continues in verse 22. Then Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took the garment, laid it upon their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were turned backward so that they did not see their father's nakedness. Here again we see the mention of Ham, the father of Canaan. Remember, that's strange. Why keep mentioning his fourth son? We see that in the next chapter, Genesis 10, verse 6, the sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. Now, Ham sees the nakedness of his father. Here we see further speculations that are to arise. What does this nakedness mean? If you read Leviticus 18, you will see uncover their nakedness as a phrase referring to many sexual sins. And those have been connected to this passage. Now, if we remember, Hebrew is a language of more than just word-for-word kind of translation. The words before and after it are very important to understanding meaning. And I'm told that the phrasing is slightly different between here and Leviticus 18, but that wasn't something that I could prove. What we do see here, though, in the original, is that Ham took some kind sort of joy out of seeing his father naked. Nothing disgusting, but more of a rebellious kind of joy in seeing his father humiliated. And instead of responding like a good son, he went and he told his two brothers outside, looking to humiliate their father further. His brothers, however, responded like good sons and put a cloak on their shoulders and backed into the tent to cover him so they would not see his nakedness. And here we get to the crazy part. Verse 24. Then Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." What does Canaan have to do with his father seeing his grandfather naked? It makes no sense for Noah to curse Canaan when Ham committed the sin. And I think, and again, you can read countless things on people filling the gaps here. You know, Canaan was beside his dad, or whatever other scenarios they offer. And I think it's important here for us to draw back, to remember the flow of the narrative. Ham sees, goes and tells his brothers respond differently than he did, right? We're seeing a bit of a flow there. And then also to remember who it is that this was written to. Israel is headed to a land of promise, which is the land of Canaan. We know in Genesis 15, when this land is promised to Abraham, God says what the Israelites will need to endure. Genesis 15, 13 to 16 says, "Then God said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your seed will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs. They will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years, but I will also judge the nation to whom they were enslaved, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete.'" And the Amorites were a tribe within the people known as the Canaanites, which we actually see in Genesis 10 again. God is pointing out the reason for which the Canaanites will be struck down by the Israelites. Their sin is complete. And God is using the Israelites as judgment. And since this story is written for the purpose of the Israelites, this is why we see the focus upon Canaan and not Ham. In my mind, this made the most sense in looking to understand this text. This is how you could sum up the whole of it. As we will notice here in the next few passages, Ham is not without consequence, as he receives no blessing from his father and is simply omitted or ignored from the order as if he did not exist. But either way, Noah wakes up and knows what his youngest son has done and curses Ham, his youngest son, by extension, and he blesses the two brothers who treated him with honor. Shem, through whom we will have the Israelites, he is the reason they're known as Semites, and Japheth and his descendants are blessed as well. And true to this blessing, Canaan's descendants do become the servants of the Jews. After this curse upon Canaan and the blessing upon Shem and Japheth, we're told Noah lives 350 years after the flood and dies at a ripe old age of 950 years. That's a lot. It's an interesting and complicated story that just seems to end very abruptly. But like all of Genesis, the point is made. The three points that show that regardless of circumstance, man's heart tends towards evil. And man's heart is still evil from his youth and cannot cease to sin apart from God, that mankind will always require rescue. We saw that the righteous remnant, knowing the consequence that sin is, having seen the sinful world before the flood and being given a second chance at the promise from the garden, essentially what Noah got after coming off the ark, didn't remain sinless. Didn't raise a society without sin, because man left to their own devices can never be sinless. We saw that even though God makes a sweeping promise for all of creation where man's redemption from the previous sinful world and the wrath that came because of it was sealed with a sign, was ratified, and still with such an event, man still returns to sin. It isn't a sign that will keep men changed. Because man, regardless of circumstance and the signs they are given, can never be sinless. We saw in Noah that man's heart is always ready to regress, that if man is not careful, if we do not always be vigilant and keep our eyes on the Lord, then we too shall fail, because in the end we haven't been saved to stand on our own. Sure, man can't be sinless, but God provides a way for man to be right with him, whether through the provision of a symbol of atonement, pointing to a coming Messiah, or eventually through the atonement of Christ. It's faith in God that saves mankind from their sin. We haven't been saved to now go and keep ourselves holy. We've been saved to show the one upon whom we lean, that it is God and God alone who redeems mankind. It is God and God alone who keeps mankind. We've seen in our text today that mankind will always require rescue. What's our application? What's our takeaway from all of this? I think the Israelites would have seen their own need. as they are headed out to begin a new nation, a nation under God, they would have seen that their hope wasn't in them being perfect, wasn't in a land without idolatry after they've eradicated all the other nations and they get to start fresh. The hope isn't the fact that they're in a land free from influence. Their hope was in God alone. And I think that's very relevant for us. We don't go on holy crusades and eradicate all the sinners. We don't try and make a land that is perfect in that way, because we realize through these previous examples, one, that that's not what's commanded, but also that that isn't enough for us. Sin is a matter of the heart. Their hope was to be and was in God alone. Simply put, as if we want to wrap this up into a very neat slogan, one that I've heard was, the best of men are men at best. I've always liked that slogan because it doesn't matter how great someone seems, it doesn't matter how together someone may have it, sin is always looking to devour those who are not careful. The fall is always possible on this side of eternity. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall." And Noah, though a righteous man, the only righteous man left, was preserved through God's judgment against the world and their sin, he still sinned. And as I said last weekend at church camp, the Bible makes it a point of drawing attention to the sins of these great men because none of them is Christ. And here we see the humanity of Noah. Though a righteous man, given a fresh start, a clean slate, a new world without any visible sin, and yet in only a short amount of time, we find sin not only in the righteous man, but continuing in his descendants. All who continue after their father, Adam, the one through whom sin entered the world, just continues making more images of himself in humanity. God even makes a covenant with Noah and his descendants that never again will he destroy the world with a flood. We see them recognize their privileged position and that they were saved from judgment because of the provision of God. In his warning them and requiring them to build an ark and keeping them through the time of the flood, that's why they offered those offerings as soon as they were off the ark. But even with this great event, this giant reminder in their lives of the goodness of God and his redemption of them, still sin remains. And as men take their eyes off God, get lost in the mundane of everyday life, suddenly man finds sin trapping them in their unawareness and dragging them down. What's our takeaway? That no matter who you are, no matter your situation in life, no matter what you've been through, no matter what you have had to do, and no matter what you still have to do, you must keep your eyes on God. There is no other hope. There is no other way. Man cannot be perfect. Only God can be perfect. And so when man is then called to be holy, man's response is not to be, "But this is impossible, so why would I even try?" Rather, it is to be, "Father, this is impossible for me. Accomplish this in me, I pray." We are always to focus on God, to depend on God, to be weak in ourselves and to utterly rely on God, because man alone cannot be sinless. Man alone cannot be perfect. We need the divine. We need God. We need God in us in order to be acceptable before God. We need Christ. May we see the example of Noah and glue our eyes to the Lord, realizing our own weakness before it's too late. And while it is yet today, may we repent of our sin, forsaking the deception that leads to hardness that is inherent in sin, and follow the pure truth that is found in the Word of God. Bow with me, please. Dear Lord, as we come before you and we see the proclivity towards sin that is in man, the leaning towards wandering, I pray that you would help us not be lulled by the peace times. There are times in our life when things seem to be going well and we tend to wander from prayer or wander from our diligence. I pray that we would see and be always in a wartime kind of thinking. Would it be that our hearts were always bent towards knowing you as best as we can with every fiber of our being, with every moment of our effort? Because in reality, you are the only one worth knowing. And it is in those times of peace where we are strengthened for when the trials would come. And
so I pray that you would help us to be a people who are aware, who keep our focus on you, and who depend on you for every moment of this life. In your holy name we pray. Amen.